Welcome to this Knox College recording, featuring the sounds and voices of the Knox community.
Well, I just need to welcome you and thank you so much for coming. And Keith, some of you may have been in 2004, did a previous talk on Kerry and Bush.
Oh, my. Did I?
That election cycle. Yeah, on the CU campus.
Right.
And then you'll see, I'm sure, throughout Keith's talk why in, I think it was 2010, he won an Alumni Achievement Award. And he just back for the first time in, a year and a half teaching a class, or classes.
Two.
Versus spending time as the chief economist for the State Department in Washington. And Keith will talk about talk about that experience.
A little bit,
yeah. So again, thank you so much. And
sure, Ann.
It's your
okay.
floor.
Well, thanks to all of you for coming and spending a beautiful Saturday afternoon here listening to me. I'm flattered, to say the least. This is a little bit ironic because the request for doing this came from Lyndon, who is now in Europe or something, is that right? So I'm glad that all of you were able to come, though. So what I'm going to just talk about for it's probably 30 or 40 minutes, and then I hope we can have a lively conversation, is a little bit about my experience in the Trump administration. I was an accidental economist in the Trump administration. I'll explain that in a moment. And then tell you some views I have about the sort of major economic initiatives from the Trump administration. I have to tell you, this is likely to get a little bit wonky here and there, and I'm just going to apologize ahead of time. So by all means, ask questions or throw an eraser at me or whatever it is that that you can do to have me slow down and explain what I mean. A little bit of personal background for you. So I've been on the faculty here at CU for centuries now, since 1981. And I've had the good fortune of being able to go off and do interesting things in my career a number of times. I won't bore you with details, but just to give you a sense of it, I spent a year as a lead economist at the World Bank, which is, by the way, why I'm using a PowerPoint. I learned at the World Bank never to go out and give a talk unless you have a PowerPoint presentation or something like it. Other things as well, but I was recruited at the tail end of the Obama administration by Secretary Kerry to be the chief economist of the State Department. Now, Secretary Kerry and his undersecretary, really brilliant woman, knew that they wouldn't be there past January, but at the time I was talking to them, we all kind of had a different expectation about the way the election would go. And it was, you know, personally a disappointment in many ways, but interesting. I was planning to be in Washington for a couple of years and working on what was going to be a pretty large initiative to link trade policy with important labor market adjustment and assistance programs, which I think would have been a centerpiece of the Clinton administration had that happened. Sadly, from my perspective, there's no such thing going on that I can tell anywhere in Washington now. A lot of trade policy, for sure. So that was why I was there. The time in the State Department was interesting. I had a lot of opportunities to interact with some of the trade officials in the White House, certainly some of the Treasury officials and people at the Commerce Department and so on, about all manner of issues involving international economics. So just to give you one example, when the Republican Congress and the Trump administration were first talking about tax reform, part of what they were looking to do was to put in what we call a border tax adjustment. And that would get really wonky if I tried to explain it to you. It is what most of the world does. And when you hear to replace the corporate income tax with that, basically, and when you hear Donald Trump saying that Mexico has a 16% tariff on imports and this is not fair, that's actually not right. They do have an adjustment of cost on imports coming in of 16%, but that's just a component of their value-added tax. Enough of that. I'm not going to go any further than that unless you really want to hear about it. Okay. The point being, they didn't really understand what a border tax adjustment was. I had the opportunity to explain it to them. I don't think that they still understand it. But partly because of all this work going on in the government, that disappeared from the ultimate tax reform. It's not in there. And then had a number of occasions to speak with people in the administration about things like China policy. And full disclosure, just so you know, the last thing I did before leaving Washington was to serve on the team of economists that were doing an assessment of the economic damages the American economy suffers, we think, from the Chinese theft of intellectual property rights. You've heard about that case. So I was and remained a bit involved in that one. So enough on that.
Did you take someone's place as a chief economist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the history of that office is a short one. It was actually started by Secretary Clinton in 2011, I think. And so between that and the time I arrived, there were five chief economists. And the model was that a visiting academic would come in and sort of direct the research in this office. And we were doing really interesting research on issues like Russian sanctions and refugee settlements in the United States and so on. But the first thing that Secretary Tillerson did when he arrived was implement, which is still in place, a hard hiring freeze in the State Department. So anybody there who was on a visiting appointment like me or the other economists or and now all of the scientists are now gone from the State Department. We can talk more about that if you like. It was people there are, well, let's just say they have mixed feelings about what's going on in the State Department. So what is Trumponomics? Nobody knows. Which is why this word doesn't appear very often in the popular press. But you hear it. So to me, it's some mixture of the following things. One, and maybe most important, doing what status quo Republicans want them to do, which is largely why we have this big tax reform in place, but also all of these attempts, which will return, I'm sure, to kill Obamacare. And as I said, in many ways, you can think about what's been happening in Washington, all of the tweets and everything else aside, as a pretty standard Republican administration in many ways. But we also have what's new. This America First populism that you've heard all about. I'll say some more about that. But that means, I think, trying to bring back manufacturing jobs. I'm sorry to say this, but there just isn't any real likelihood that that's going to happen in the volume that we would need. So to put that in some perspective, I don't know if you know this, but the sort of loss of American manufacturing prowess began in the early 1980s. And by about 1995, we had already sort of deindustrialized in a major way. What did happen when China joined the international trading system in 2001 is after that, and then up through about 2011, the United States lost about 12 million manufacturing jobs. The biggest component, the biggest contributor to that being the financial crisis. But a lot of that is coming back now for sort of standard economic reasons. But the tariffs that might, we think, someday be put on steel and aluminum are not going to have much impact, I'm afraid, on that. Try to rebalance the global trading and financial system that some, and certainly the president, and I'll give him credit for being consistent. He's been complaining about this for a long, long time, long before he was president, that some see as unfair to the United States. The best example that you would get from the administration is this incredible fixation the president has on the trade deficit. Part of what I tried to do without success in Washington was talk to not other economists, because they sort of see the world the same way I do in Washington, but the policymakers from the law side and sort of the industry side who really think that Americans have a big trade deficit because the rest of the world is treating us unfairly. And the fact of the matter is that we have a large trade imbalance, or what we call current account imbalance, because we just don't save very much. We have very low savings rates compared to our expenditure. And when that's the case, a big component of that is the government deficit. And the fact that the government deficit is going to blow up soon is another problem here I'll come back to. But in that situation, you're just going to necessarily be importing more than you're exporting and have to borrow from the rest of the world to finance that. And that's not going to go away anytime soon. In fact, I expect that to get bigger. And so what will frustrate the president, I'm sure, is observing the trade imbalance getting bigger, even though he's trying hard through these trade mechanisms to do something about that. Radically limit immigration, although for no apparent economic reason that I've been heard put out there. I mean, there's a lot of political reasons for that, but not any good economics behind it. An obscure and always changing linkage of economic policy with foreign policy. So I'm going to come back to this a little bit later, but the president is kind of in this bind, which is he wants to hit the Chinese with some sort of punitive tariffs for lots of reasons, but at the same time, he has to have the Chinese cooperate with North Korea, and he wants to deal with the Iranians by pulling out of that agreement, but at the same time, the European partners in that agreement, they don't want to pull out of it because they have a lot of trade contracts with Iran. And so there's all of this sort of constrained foreign policy that's limiting what the man can do in the economic policy realm. And it's just really hard to know day to day how that's going to go. And then the last part of this is uncertainty and threats. Everything is negotiable many times over. And I don't know if that would be what you would always get with a business person in the White House, but it certainly seems to be true here that the president thinks that you can run a government the same way you can run a construction company. There may be some truth to that in some locations, but running the American government, which has global responsibilities, that's just not a sustainable thing to try to do. So it's all very confusing, and you know this as well as I do from reading these tweets. So I don't ever recall seeing this kind of approach before. Okay, I'm going to try to keep this as unwonky as I can, but as I said before, I'll just apologize in advance. If you want my sense or thinking about tax reform, I'll do that for you now. So let's start with the one that most directly affects all of us, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the TCJA. I did work on this some, at least from the perspective of the State Department. You should probably understand why Secretary Clinton put that chief economist office together in the first place, now that I think about it. So she's a very wonky person and got this idea that maybe it would be wise or useful to have some economists around the State Department to sort of advise on whether this kind of trade policy or that kind of financial policy or doing something in terms of sanctions on cybersecurity, what would the effects of that be on the American economy? That's the kind of thing that we would be working on. And so when I was there, one of the big issues was the lead up to this tax reform. And so on behalf of the State Department, I would go to various meetings, usually in Treasury, and talk to them about it. So was this a good idea? I'll say more about that. But I can tell you that I think, and probably you would get a consensus from nearly all economists in the United States, that reforming the American tax system was way overdue and should have been done a long time ago. So first, you know, what do we need a tax system to do? Well, you want to have pretty simple rules that people can understand. You want to have, and they need to be consistent across all taxpayers, right? Not special favors for some and not others. You want enough revenue generated to actually finance government spending. You want efficient revenue generation, which means that the tax system should extract at the least cost the revenues you need. If you put into a tax system all kinds of distortions and special cases and exemptions and special deal here, special deal there, the efficiency of the system just dramatically diminishes. And so the American tax system was generating way less revenue than you would think it should. And you'd want the tax burden to be pretty equitable across groups and over time. We talk a lot, and you've heard a lot, you talk a lot yourself, I'm sure, about the burden that is being placed on future generations from our unwillingness to tax ourselves now. That's a big question. And I teach, so I can tell you that these days, one of the biggest questions students will always have, for an economist anyway, is how worried should we be about this? If you want to ask me that later, I'll tell you my answer to that. And then try to have favorable incentives as neutral as possible to encourage innovation, production, dealing with various market failures. So just, I'm not going to say much more about this kind of thing, but I will just tell you, to me, this big tax reform exercise was a missed opportunity in many ways, one of which was it could have been linked in with some changes in labor taxation, especially a climate change carbon tax, to try to get at some of these other problems and generate a lot of revenue at the same time. So how were we doing in this country before this reform? Pretty badly in just about every dimension that I just had on that screen up there. Okay, so just one example, the U.S. corporate income tax. It was inefficient at revenue generation. We have estimates that suggest the corporate income tax was raising about 30 to 40% of the revenue it was expected to generate, given its tax rates and its incentives and disincentives and so on. Easy thing to evade. The biggest way it was evaded, I think it's one of these points up here, was that you could just, in a world of international corporations, transfer as much of your profit as you'd like to a low-income place, or low-tax place, I should say, like Ireland, declare all of your intellectual property ownership there, declare most of your taxable revenues there, pay the tax in Ireland, but never bring it back here, because if you brought it back here, the United States had this thing called the worldwide taxing system on international income. And if you make international income, you'll know this, but whenever you bring that income back, you got to pay a 35% tax rate on it. That's the way it was. And compared to Ireland's 8% tax rate, why would you do that? So Apple, you've probably heard this, Apple is every economist's favorite example of globalization in lots of ways, but this is one of them. Apple is located in California. That's where it does virtually all of its R&D. It owns no intellectual property. I shouldn't say no. But it declares its intellectual property profits in Ireland. This is a massive problem for the Irish within the European Union, by the way, because the European Union doesn't like the fact that Ireland has these really low tax rates and all of these international technology companies declare their profits there and pay such low taxes. So filled with exemptions, special treatment, there was a high top tax rate in the corporate income tax. In the OECD, the other major industrial countries, the average tax rate on corporate income before this tax reform was about 25, 23%. Okay? That might surprise you, I don't know, but it was. So all kinds of distortions in this system, and this was generating only about 30 to 40% of expected revenues. And then you all know how complicated the personal income tax system is. What more do I need to say about this? It takes me days to do my taxes, and I have no idea if I'm even close to being right. All right, so this reform, it tries to address some of these problems. And so what I'm going to sort of do, again, you can ask questions, but if I see glazed eyes, I'm just going to move on. try to give you a sense of what I think makes sense, what we don't know about yet, and what was really bad idea. Okay. Yes, Karen.
Yeah. I just have a basic question. I hear people arguing about whether this was tax reform or whether it was just tax cuts. Does it matter what we're labeling it?
Well, almost any politician will label anything like this a tax reform because it sounds better. But there's a lot of reform in this policy. It's not just tax cutting taxes altogether, by any means. But it wasn't what the Republicans set out to do. So here's some good things, and I emphasize to economists anyway, a lot of others who might not think these are good things, in the changes in the personal income tax. Well, one thing is it eliminates the personal exemption and almost doubles the standard deduction. Now, if you're Knox College, this is bad news. Because what this will do is dramatically reduce the number of people who itemize deductions. And of course, the great thing about itemizing deductions is you can take those off your taxes, those charitable contributions off your taxes. So I tell you, the college is trying to think through exactly how they're going to convince everybody in this room to give them more money, and how and when, right? But as a matter of economic policy, this makes a lot of sense, because a world in which wealthy people get a really big tax break because they decided to give money to some dodgy charities is a world in which you have to wonder how efficient is that system. $10,000 limit on deduction for state and property taxes. I don't see as a matter of economics why there should be a deduction for those taxes at all. What happens under those circumstances is that you put in those deductions and the high income tax places, states raise their tax rates. They just offset that. So anytime there's a reduction in the federal income tax for this purpose, there's just an increase in tax rates. It's kind of like universities and colleges. You know, whenever the government puts in some kind of tax advantage for saving for college or university, we just raise our tuition rates. You know, it's just sort of what happens in a dynamic market. Reduce the mortgage debt limit, and that's a really good thing because there's almost no reason to think that low-income taxpayers should be subsidizing high-income taxpayers with heavy mortgages. This is, I think most of us economists would argue, probably the single biggest financial distortion in the United States, this idea that you can deduct the interest you pay on home mortgage. Especially, if you even want to think that this encourages home ownership, it doesn't very much. But even if you believe that, we have, under the old law, home mortgage interest deductions for your second home and your third home. This doesn't really make a lot of sense as a matter of tax policy. And then it raises income thresholds subject to the alternative minimum tax, so less of us will get hit by that every year. Some questionable things. Are these good ideas? Well, cuts these marginal tax rates, as you were saying, Karen, especially the middle range. It's not a bad idea, but that's going to lose the government a lot of revenue. Extends the tax exemption for saving for education to private elementary and secondary schools. I don't know if you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but this will be a tax advantage for fairly high-income folks who don't want to contribute to public education. And bad ideas, really bad ideas. And again, from my standpoint as an economist, okay, this thing removes the individual insurance mandate in the Affordable Care Act. So the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been reasonably effective at bringing people who are uninsured into the system. When that mandate goes away, the cost will skyrocket, and you'll see several million people lose their insurance. That'll happen next year, 2019. Doubles the estate tax exemption. And by the way, that means even though they didn't kill Obamacare, they've sort of taken one of the three steps of its stool out, so it's in some trouble. Doubles the estate tax exemption to $11 billion. Good thing, bad thing, I don't know. I mean, as a matter of sort of equity, I think that's a problem. Sorry?
Million.
I'm sorry. Well, this is what happens to you in the government. Billion, yeah. Yes, a million.
Is that Buffett?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so that's the Jeff Bezos tax advantage. And then, these cuts in these income tax rates, I don't really know this, they will expire in 2025. You've probably heard that. What will not expire, all the corporate income tax rates cuts. So at some point, what will not expire, all the corporate income tax cuts. So at some point, there will be this reckoning that has to be paid. 2025 is convenient. Why is it convenient? Donald Trump thinks he'll get reelected in 2020. Then 2024 comes along. Some Republican, maybe Dean Pence, thinks he'll get elected. And then there's 2025 after all that happens, right? So some good things in the corporate income tax. Replaces the graduated corporate income tax rates. The United States was the only place, major country in the world, that had that, with a flat rate of 21%. We can argue whether that rate is too high or too low. Doubles the investment expense limitation to $1 million. What that means is if you make an, well, if your company makes an investment in machinery or land or something, then you can take $1 million off your taxes from that cost right now, this year. And that's supposed to increase incentives for investment. A number of business-related deductions will be phased out or limited. It'll be much more difficult to write off your Rockies tickets, for example. I think that's good. Probably good things, but could have done better. Could have been done better. Eliminates the tax. This is... if you want to ask me questions, do, but this is the sort of wonkiest this date. This is going to get here, okay? Eliminates the tax on repatriated dividends earned in foreign subsidiaries. That may sound like an obscure thing. It is pretty arcane, but the fact is that a lot of companies don't bring back dividends earned on their foreign operations because of the 35% tax I told you about on repatriation. That's going to go away. Introduces a new but low tax rate on intangible profits earned by U.S. subsidiaries in low-tax foreign countries. What does that mean? That's the Ireland problem I was talking about, trying to deal with that. So it's unfortunate in my mind because I think this tax bill could have been written in consultation, in cooperation with the rest of Europe and Japan to come up with a coordinated system. And those countries were pretty far along that path before the Trump election. To come up with a way of disciplining these kinds of tax wars that you get. Now the Americans are going to have a tax rate on this invisible income, which means intellectual property, profits basically, that competes with the Irish interest rate, sorry, tax rate. And so we may actually see the Americans becoming a tax haven. And then this tax on foreign-owned profits reduced from the 35% I mentioned. It'll become something like 8 to 15% through 2025, and then it will be abolished. It will go away if this tax reform doesn't change. So foreign income for corporations after 2025 won't be taxed at all by the United States. Now, again, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here. There are some reasons for arguing for that, because it shifts this worldwide taxation system that we have. We're the only ones that do that. To a more of a destination-based tax system, and there's some reasons to do that. But I just want you to understand, that's a really big tax cut, okay? Really big tax cut. And the bad thing, this establishes, in my mind, still, this establishes a 20% deduction from income for pass-through entities. You know what a pass-through entity is?
LLCs.
They are examples of the pass-through entities. So basically, individually owned companies, partnerships, where the income, the residual income, the profits, pass through as your own private household income. So that's all taxed currently as just regular income in the personal income tax. What this thing is going to do is give dentists and doctors and lawyers and people who own construction companies in New Jersey a 20% deduction on all of their taxable income right off the top. And they're doing this because the argument that the Republicans made on this is that's basically what you have to do to give these guys a tax in their business income that's comparable to what the corporations are getting with the cuts in the corporate income tax. But what you will see, I think it's fairly clear, is that everyone in your family, including your favorite aunts, will become pass-through entities before too long. So there are some safeguards in this law to try to prevent that from it. But the incentive to do that is really huge. Because 20% right off the top is a big, big tax cut. Yeah.
Is it going to get too far off into wonkiness to explain what I've been led to understand? That this is going to allow even increased non-hiring people, franchising everything out and all that stuff, or, you know, it's the freelance economy, where you can disguise your people as, you know, they're on their own.
Well, I, you know, we don't know what the reactions will be, but that is likely to be one. I'm sure there are tax lawyers and tax accountants all over the country now trying to figure out how to make every one of your employees a pass-through entity. Sure. So this is, why is that bad? Well, partly because it's such an inequitable treatment. If you don't have that kind of company and you don't qualify for that kind of company, you're not going to get this advantage. That's one thing. For another, it's going to set up these distortions that we were just talking about. And for third, that's a massive killer in terms of revenues. That really will reduce revenues generated from this tax system. All right, what do I think about this? What do economic models expect will result from this tax reform? This is a very complicated question. I'm just going to give you the sort of bottom line here. The good, sort of, but disappointing. Economic growth. So this whole tax reform sold by the Republicans as a way to reinvigorate investment, generate more economic growth. They think ultimately that's going to generate a lot more employment and raise wages, and that's the whole argument there. Okay, so on their own grounds. Well, I think at least models suggest there will be some short-term gain in output in the next couple of years, maybe 0.6, 0.7% increase in GDP. I don't know if that sounds like a large number to you or not. You kind of have to be in the economics game to sort of put some context into that. It's a rare thing that actually increases the size of this economy by 1%. Really rare, because the economy is so huge. 1% of a $22 trillion economy, you can work it out. I think it's in the billions, not the millions. I think many hundreds of billions of dollars. So 0.8% is a lot of additional GDP, right? But the inability of this program to actually deal with the budget deficit and the implications of the larger budget deficit to come suggests that over the long term, that's going to drive up interest rates and some other things and generate just a modest long-term contribution, maybe 0.3% higher GDP. By 2030, what the Republicans would have told you, but they will still tell you, if they're not bothered by economists with their models, is that, oh, in 2030, we'll have a 6 or 7 or 10% higher GDP. And you have to have that kind of outcome if you want to argue that this is going to pay for itself. Okay? So it's not going to. What about, oh, yeah, okay.
But didn't we have a fairly decent the economic growth? Well, the only thing that was kind of a negative there was people's wages.
Yeah.
That other parts of the economy were actually recovering, and why would you want to stimulate that?
Yeah, so the question, hello. The question is, we're already robustly growing, which is true. We have a new definition of robustly growing for the rich countries. We're going to get 2.5%, maybe 3% this year. That's really high in real terms compared to where we've been the last 15 or so years. So it's a good question. Why would you want to throw this kind of stimulus into that? I think what the tax reformers would tell you is there's no good time other than the politics of it. At some point, you have to reform the tax system. But it is kind of ironic because this is going to put a lot more sort of government juice, if you will, into the economy just at a time we're already growing rapidly. But some positive long-term contribution. This estimate is basically what I would call a consensus or average estimate across about a dozen models. Okay, some actually think there'll be negative growth from this, but I would guess not. But what this means is the sort of high-level forecast that say this tax cut will pay for itself, and in a matter of a few years, we'll have a budget surplus. That's just not in the cards. Don't even imagine that can happen. Business investment and real wages, it's really too soon to know much about this, but this tax reform is expected to cut net taxes on the S&P 500 companies between $75 and $100 billion this year. That's a big number in the context of the American budget. Okay. If you add that, the higher income taxpayers will probably get a tax cut on the order of $50 billion. You can see that these are large numbers.
How much?
$50 billion or so. So surveys of experts suggest, and there aren't many surveys, and who knows what the experts are. These are economists, accountants, and so on. About 50% of these tax cuts will likely go to dividends and stock buybacks and repaying debt. That's not surprising, because that's often what happens when there's a tax cut in the corporate sector. Really, you know, buying back your shares of your corporation is a very strategic thing to do, because it does lots for you. It makes your shareholders happy as the price goes up. It removes some shares from circulation, so you end up with more control over the operations of the corporation. So this is not unusual at all. Maybe 23% in new investment. That, you know, the new investment will take quite some time, of course. And then this is a survey result, 12% to wage increases. Now, I think that's probably understating the thing, because after all, if this investment does happen, that will feed into higher real wages in the long run, because the more investment there is, the more R&D there is, the higher our real wages. At the same time, I would caution real advocates of this thing, because this advantage tax treatment for investment will, of course, be applied fully to investments in automation and robotics, and those are the things that really have been pushing people out of the manufacturing workforce. So chances are that will be accelerated rather than decelerated by this tax reform. Okay, so that was, what did I call it, the good but disappointing? Here's the bad. I'm working on a movie title here. You may have recognized it by now. Okay. Government borrowing, I've already mentioned this, but there will be large increases in budget deficits. I think I have my digits right this time. Should add up to about $1.5 trillion to government borrowing by 2025. So is that a large number? Yes, it is. The government currently has about a $700 billion claim through the financial markets. That's what it has to borrow. So it's going to be doubling that, basically, on an annual basis. Sharp increase in federal debt as a percentage of GDP, if you want to see the numbers. This is from the Congressional Budget Office. Again, you know, I think charts are cool, but I'll just try to explain this to you. The thing on the top left there is their best estimate of what will happen to... expenses on the top by the federal government and revenues on the bottom by the federal government. Again, this is the Congressional Budget Office. Right? This is not some fly-by-night economist sitting in Boulder, Colorado doing this. The Republicans would tell you the bottom line will cross the top line soon, and no reasonable economist would agree with that. So what this says is, what's going to happen is revenues will sort of chug along, getting up to 16-17% of GDP, outlays, expenses will chug along, getting up to 24-25% of GDP. So at the end of this period, if they're right, the U.S. government deficit as a percentage of the size of the American economy will be about 7 or 8% of gross domestic product. Is that a big number? That's the number that kicks the IMF into action when they're worried about a developing country having too much debt. Okay. And this number here says that under their projections, the debt is the accumulation of all the government deficits. So how much does the government actually owe? Between now and 2028, we'll actually hit 100% of GDP. Is that a large number? It's never been that level, even during World War II. So these are large changes, okay? Large changes going on. And what would have happened without this tax reform? I think something a bit like that. Probably not as extreme, but it would have been a lot better if you sort of thought of a better way to do this tax reform, one that is less inefficient than this one will be. and less biased in the ways it is. So, government borrowing. Here's another interesting one. Now, this probably, you won't understand what I'm talking about, but since I'm an international economist, I have to tell you, impacts on the trade deficit. So the increase in public borrowing here will have a couple of effects. One is directly, when the government, any government, when a federal government runs a deficit, it has to borrow that money, right? It has ways to do that. It can go sell bonds to you and me. So if you've got any Series E bonds, that's what you've done. You've lent money to the government. It can tell the central bank, we want you to buy our bonds. This is what we mean by printing money. You've heard that phrase before, printing money? That's what it means when the federal government tells the central bank to buy up its bonds so that it can keep running large deficits. Fortunately, in this economy, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, is independent of the White House and Congress. Let's hope that doesn't change, because it's really an important element of American policymaking. But in many developing countries like Venezuela, that's the problem. The third way they do it is borrow from abroad. Okay, so what this expansion of the need to borrow is going to do is just increase borrowing from abroad, and dollar for dollar, as we borrow more from abroad, that raises the trade deficit, raises the current account. And so despite the president's very clearly stated preference for reducing the trade deficit, unless something else happens, it's going to get bigger, not smaller. It already is getting bigger, as you can tell, if you look at the data. So I expect that will frustrate some people in Washington. The ugly inequality. So something like 85% of the tax cuts will go to corporations and the top 10% of income holders, wealth holders. Marginal tax cuts for households, though, will expire in 2025. And third thing, I know you've heard this in the news, it's a fair claim in my mind. These higher budget deficits are going to raise big political fights about cutting entitlements sooner rather than later, I think. So that's my story on this. How about trade? Trumponomics too. Well, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Yes?
Yeah, it's pretty clear with the last tax bill that people are getting kind of hip to economic models and looking at CBO projections and things like that. And you can save your answer to this till later, because it's kind of a big question, I think. What's your opinion, or what are your ideas about the effectiveness of economic models? Are they getting that much better? Certainly computers are getting bigger. What's going to be the political impact of better and better economic models?
Well, I'll say a little bit about that now. If you want to raise it again later, fine. You know, the economists took a big black eye, and a well-deserved black eye, in the financial crisis, because there were economists saying there's, you know, there are red lights flashing, but not many. And those models just failed. And what that means largely is that economic models are fine until things really go haywire, and then they economic models get quite sophisticated, but in the end, what they really do is say, this variable has been going up like this, it's probably going to continue going up like that, okay? That's kind of what it is. So they work well when the economy is under reasonably normal circumstances, and I would listen to economic forecasts pretty closely and look at the average so you get some sense of it. But when there's a catastrophe of some kind, who knows what's going to happen.
But you don't see any heavy-duty technical innovations in economic models. They're just getting more fine-grained detail.
Well, I don't want to overstate that criticism I just made. There are very sophisticated economic models that are deeply mathematical, and the ones I read myself the most have to do with climate change, sort of the economic reactions to the need to deal with climate change. But having said that, do I think they'll change the politics? They won't in Washington for any time soon. One thing I discovered in Washington is there really isn't much interest or sympathy for economic models there now. But maybe in the longer run. Karen? Yeah.
So is there much of a consensus about trickle down at this point among economists?
There has been a consensus about that for a long time, which is these statements are always oversimplified. You could get some trickle down if there weren't structural barriers in place to actually see the income redistributed through wage growth, but there are those kinds of barriers in place. So I think most economists would argue that a long period of growth generates with it some wage growth, to be sure. But the idea that tax cuts themselves ultimately generate very much in the way of trade growth, wage growth, is just not what we agree. We just don't see much evidence of that.
So is it your sense that politicians who still use that line just don't believe what the economists are saying, or it's just...
No, I think a little bit of both of that. I mean, it's inconvenient to believe what scholars and evidence are telling you sometimes, and so might as well just ignore it. But I think there is some ideology that gets drilled into some, you know, especially right-wing Republican politicians about that issue particularly. And so, you know, the evidence on this is very clear. There's very little evidence that you get significant trickle down. That it would take so long to do that the economy is going to be completely changed by the time you get to that time. So we just don't see much evidence of it at all. The only time that economists would agree that a major tax cut generated wage increases was the Kennedy tax cuts in the early 1960s. There apparently was, you know, I think we could make a case for there being some impact on wages that time, but we haven't seen much of it since then.
What would the Maskus tax reform have looked like? Just highlights there.
Highlights. Well, definitely a cut in the corporate income tax and a flat corporate income tax. In terms of international taxation of corporate income, it would have been what I suggested, which is cooperation with the other industrial countries on a sort of a harmonized kind of treatment of things like invisible property, intellectual property. And then otherwise, what we call a destination-based tax system that's focused more on consumption taxes than on income taxes. I don't know how you feel about that. But again, most of us in my business think that consumption-based taxes are more efficient than income-based taxes, because income taxes are easy to evade. They generate disincentives at the margin to do things that you don't want to see in there. Consumption taxes are what they are. I mean, they're regressive because low-income people pay a bigger part of their income on consumption than higher-income people do, but you can't really escape the fact that the tax goes up the more expensive the thing is you buy. And there are ways you can sort of make things more progressive. One thing I would argue, for example, is the payroll tax, right? The payroll tax, the FICA tax, you all know and love that one. It kicks out at a maximum of $115,000, I think, something like that. $115,000 in this day and age is a high salary for most people, but it's not for the people who make a lot of money. And they sort of generate a large incentive for themselves that way. So I would probably take the tax cap off that altogether. Say, whatever wage income you make, that's what you pay us that. Right? That simple thing right there would fix the Social Security problem. So a few other things, but yeah, okay. All right, trade protection. You've all seen the headlines. There are people who wish I wouldn't refer to China as our enemy. That's exactly what they are. They have destroyed entire industries by utilizing low-wage workers. Cost us tens of thousands of jobs. By the way, I'm surprised by that number, because he could have said millions and been right. Spied on our businesses, that's true. Stolen our technology, also true. And have manipulated and devalued their currency, which makes importing our goods more expensive and sometimes impossible. That's actually not a stupid statement, like this one. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster done and pushed by special interests. Well, that actually is not stupid. Any trade agreement is pushed by special interests, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership was actually, I don't want to get into the weeds again, that would really get us down in there, but in my mind, something that the United States should have joined. NAFTA is the worst trade deal and maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. And trade wars are good and easy to win. Take my word for it, trade wars are not good. And probably not easy to win either. If we get into a trade fight with China, the smart money's on Canada. Put it that way. And we've done a few things. U.S. withdraws from the TPP, first thing Trump did. Administration announces a study of the sources of bilateral trade deficits and unfair trade practices. There's a renegotiation of NAFTA going on, which is not going well. There's a U.S. investment review body that I don't need to talk about, but it's getting very interventionist about Chinese acquisitions of American technology companies. The steel and aluminum tariffs, and of course, the announced tariffs that have not yet happened on Chinese imports associated with these this theft of intellectual property. That's the one I was working on a little bit. It's an impressive record of making announcements that you're going to slow down trade. Not a lot of it has actually happened yet. And I'm sure there are people in the steel industry who are just sitting there calling the White House every day saying, when do we get our tariffs? When do we get our tariffs? So that's an interesting question, why that is being such a slow thing. Before I talk about that, though, here again, the thing about the Trump administration is they never write down any strategic documents, at least not that I've seen. And so I've just sort of sussed out for myself what the principles of Trumpian trade policy seem to be. Seems chaotic, but it seems to revolve around six pillars of America First. One is national security interests take precedence over trade relations. So if you have something in mind like North Korea or Iran and you want some outcome there, then you'll destroy trade with the country if that's with the surrounding countries if that's going to get you there, or you'll have better trade with the surrounding country if that's going to get you there. It makes deciding what trade policy really is kind of hard. Competition for technological leadership is about national security and future market shares in leading industries. So I can tell you that the biggest thing driving American trade policy in the Trump administration is this fear that what the Chinese are doing, and I don't think it's misplaced personally, that their strong rush into high technology sectors and getting there by, in essence, stealing a lot of technology has really generated some concerns about both technology and national security, and on where the American industry is going. The United States for a long time has been the technological leadership location in the world. But if you read this document called Made in China 2025, I give the Chinese some credit. They are transparent about their objectives. In 2025, they want to be the world's leader by that. The metric they have for that is at least a 60% global market share in eight very high technology sectors, which are exactly the eight that the United States thinks it's going to be leading the world in. That's 7 years from now. These are things like artificial intelligence, driverless vehicles, a lot of space exploration, and on, super high-end separate semiconductors. By the way, if you didn't know this, unless there are some there's a trade war that prevents this, probably the biggest seller of electric driverless vehicles in the United States inside of 10 years will be China. They're already selling lots of electrical vehicles. China sells more electric vehicles than any other country, but nearly all of them are sold in China. But they're getting ready to export those. U.S. manufacturing and mining workers have paid too much of the burden of globalization and need protection. Corollary of this, this is a little bit wonky again, but what the tariffs on steel and aluminum might do, and certainly what tariffs on automobiles would do if we get there, is make it more difficult for companies to have these internationally dispersed supply lines. And those are highly efficient, but what they also do is transfer a lot of activity out of the high-income countries, move us into design and R&D and that kind of stuff, but the jobs that disappear go to places like Mexico and Central America here, places like Poland and Latvia and Europe, and places like Vietnam in Asia. And so those things, like I said, they're hyper-efficient, but they do put real pressure on places like Galesburg, Illinois. Okay. Trade agreements, and I don't want to say too much about this, but clearly the administration believes that the World Trade Organization is a problem for them because it puts a lot of constraints on American decision-making. And they'd like to sort of rebalance that relationship. And the rules-based approach of past administrations like the Obama administration, the Bush administration, were ineffective at changing behavior. So what you need is confrontation and a lot of uncertainty, which will, the argument goes, achieve better results. And finally, that the U.S. can negotiate better bilateral trade agreements than regional trade agreements. I don't think there's much likelihood that that's the case, but this is how they see this here. So, an early assessment here. These really do amount to a, quote, new, unquote, vision. Some of it is new. Most of it is old-style protectionism. But there hasn't been much that's happened so far, so can it work? Here's some advantages. It really is important to modernize some of these old trade agreements. NAFTA was signed in 1994, so there's a lot of stuff that's not in there that should be in there. In case you are wondering, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, three of the members that were going to be in there were Canada, United States, and Mexico. So had it passed and all three of those countries joined, NAFTA would have disappeared. So there's no reason to renegotiate NAFTA because it would have just died, having been supplanted by this thing. Canada and Mexico, I think, are probably still going to join the TPP. We'll see where the Trump administration will go in this. I mean, already they're making noises about trying to go back and renegotiate the thing, but they're not going to get an arrangement that was nearly as advantageous to the United States as that one was. And by the way, what do I mean by modernizing? This may interest you. Very few trade agreements have in their rules on things like e-commerce and digital privacy and all of these kinds of high-tech stuff. So TPP had a lot of that in it. And I'm just going to move on beyond this. So bolder attempts to open markets and slow down industrial policy in China may be fruitful. That's the whole thing behind this big fight with the Chinese. And I personally have some sympathy for this because the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration, and then Bush, and then Obama, they've all been dealing with this, or trying to deal with this issue of what do you do with the Chinese? China, like the United States in its heyday, is a case unto itself because it's so big. It can make a lot of mistakes and still grow at 10% a year, maybe 7% a year now. And it has a lot of really poor people, but it also has hundreds of millions of engineers and scientists who are getting to be up to the frontier. And a lot of the way they did that is to send folks here to get a training in the United States, then go back and take those technologies with them. And the Chinese government has never been shy, either publicly or privately, about encouraging its companies to find these technologies in any way you can. And so these administrations for a long time have been trying to figure out what to do about it, and what they did was very little because, A, the American option was to take the Chinese to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in a lawsuit, but very little of what the Chinese actually did is illegal under global trading system rules. There just isn't enough in those rules to discipline the Chinese on this stuff. What other option would you have? Well, talk to them. And so every administration has had an annual bilateral dialogue with the Chinese, and you can just see these things year after year after year like clockwork. They focus on intellectual property. The Chinese say, okay, we'll fix that problem, and they fix half of it. And the other half is the really important half. Let's just say in terms of a bilateral game, we haven't been winning that trade war. Okay. So the third thing you do is try to convince companies to leave China, and they are starting to leave China for exactly these reasons, American companies. But the Chinese, the American companies didn't, they don't want to make a public case about being mistreated in China, because if they do that, they might get mistreated worse, and they know that. So the only thing that's left is to just say to the Chinese directly, okay, we've had enough. We think we need to come to some blows here if you're not going to act the way we think it would be more fair. That strategy is popular in Washington, I think popular among much of the corporate community, even though they wouldn't say that publicly, even among economists. I mean, we write down models that say if you've got a bad actor, at some point you've got to hit them to get them to move off that kind of strategy. So I was actually pleased to get involved in that project. Disadvantages, questionable ideas. It's really sort of a policy emphasis that's not well informed, especially in terms of these tariffs on steel and other things that are coming, NAFTA. So the idea is that these temporary trade barriers will help in letting these companies readjust and get skilled, you know, train their workers and so on. But that's really not going to happen. You're not going to get a lot of readjustment within the companies behind trade barriers. So where are we here? And Chuck, in anticipation of your next question, what would I do? I think the Chinese thing is kind of haphazard, and who knows where that's going to go, but the pressure makes some sense. The rest of this doesn't make a lot of sense to me unless you combine it with really active labor market policies to get people who are out of the workforce back into the workforce and get them retrained and so on. That's not easy, but there's nothing like that coming from Washington that I can see. The administration seems intent on treating trade policy as a series of transactions to be negotiated, not a real strategy. As like I said, there's no written down strategy that I'm aware of. There's no sense that says, here's our priority with the Chinese. We're going to go and negotiate with them. What do we say? This is really what we want. And I don't think they even know that. Many objectives would be better achieved by cooperating with lots of other major economies with similar concerns. So this Chinese high-tech industrial policy, the Europeans have said to Washington over and over again for a long time, let's collaborate on this thing. We're all suffering from this. And then the United States just decided to go it alone on this, which I found quite surprising. And then this issue of not linking trade policy very effectively with international relations is in my mind, kind of short-sighted. So the TPP, it isn't just that economically it made some sense in the United States, but what the TPP really did was say to East Asia, we're going to be there for you. We're going to have this trade agreement. The Chinese were not part of it. So we're going to sustain our leadership in the region, and pulling out of that, I think, is really going to cause some problems there. I'm running way too long, so let me just try to finish up. I will say a couple things about immigration, though. But pushback. It's probably the case that elements of this strategy may be unsustainable. First, the Trump administration has discovered that the U.S. business community generally opposes trade barriers. Big surprise. Or changes in trade agreements. Big surprise. Here are just some examples. But if you have anyone to thank for Americans going into TPP, if we do, it's hog farmers in Iowa. Because they know they're the ones who are going to get excluded, and corn farmers and wheat farmers from the Asian markets. And they also know that they're the ones who are going to suffer the retaliation in China more than anyone else if we have this trade war. The automobile sector is pushing back hard in NAFTA. Here's an interesting observation for you. We do have a trade deficit with Mexico. It's kind of large. It's $30 billion. But if you took automobiles and automobile parts out of that calculation, the United States has a big trade surplus with Mexico. The entire thing is automobiles because of these very intricate kinds of supply chains going on. And a car that you buy here may have crossed the Canadian border and the Mexican border in some form through the parts and everything else a dozen times because NAFTA has zero tariffs on that stuff. It's just, like, again, a hyper-efficient thing. Okay, result. In my mind, the great negotiator may already be boxed in because he has all these constraints coming from the American side. And the Chinese know what they want, and so do the Europeans. So I'm not sure he's going to be able to negotiate much here. A couple of comments on immigration. Yes.
This is not really related to any of this, but I did run, so I want to
hear
your thoughts.
Sure.
So I know most economists know that automation is the leader in job loss.
Absolutely.
You know, rather than trade, I also loved DPV. I'm really a I'm maybe the only person under 30 who likes DPV. big fan. So,
wow.
Okay. Yeah.
Have you read it?
I have read it.
Oh my gosh.
And also, when you talk about immigration, TPP did marvelous things for human trafficking and all of those in South Sudan. But so as we see automation increasing, and you hear people talking about universal basic income versus jobs guarantee, which one of those do you favor, and do you see the need for either or both of those?
Wow, it's such a huge question. So the question is about automation, artificial intelligence. I mean, I think most of us believe we're at the beginning of this problem, not the end. Does universal income guarantee work? It might get to that point. I don't think it's anywhere likely in political terms. The Finnish have just had an experiment with it, and they gave it up. Because even in Finland, they decided that people were sort of taking the income and choosing not to work more than they were expecting. So I don't see a lot of future for that one until things get really bleak. And I think it may be some time still before you really see wholesale job losses. Because any big technological change, and I'm sort of in the camp of economists who believes this, it destroys a lot of jobs, but it also creates a lot of jobs. And the question is, can you manage the transition? So the transition here would be two kinds of things. One is there will be a lot of jobs available in writing the software for all of this. And so can we get people to do that? And the second is we'll all sort of devolve into this service economy, which isn't necessarily bad, but the way I describe that is in the morning I do your taxes, in the afternoon you're my personal trainer, right? I mean, kind of that sort of an economy. But I think it's going to be difficult to manage that adjustment. And if we don't start now in figuring out how to work with making labor markets much more dynamic and much more focused on how you educate and train people and actually maybe subsidize people to migrate from one part of the country to another, then I think it's going to be much more difficult. Is that?
Yeah, I just would a jobs guarantee in lieu of universal basic income be more beneficial to the economy and also mentally or psychologically having that, like, I know there's a lot of like deaths of despair, what they're calling it. So is a job guarantee better for the economy overall because you have sort of like the morale?
Okay. Yeah, again, we're a long way from getting there, but my own sense of it, and I'm not an expert, we should try to get a labor economist in here, my own sense of it is that we have entered into this long-term process that may take many more generations that will continue to generate more inequality, will continue to generate sort of returns to skills that are extreme, and we'll, you know, the sort of ability of people biologically to evolve is nowhere near that fast, and so you have to be pretty interventionist, pretty activist in what you're going to do. And so we might just have to figure out a way, and this is what some brand new great politician might do in the next presidential election or two, start talking about this, is starting to tax the winners much more than we have and using the proceeds from that to try to figure out if it's straight out redistribution or maybe using some guarantees for government jobs, as long as those government jobs are actually doing something useful. But another thing the Trump administration talks about but they haven't anything about is an infrastructure investment program, and that's one way you could get at that. Yeah, okay, sure.
Okay, a little bit on immigration. You've seen these kinds of quotes as well. We don't need to go through those again, other than Mexico will pay for the wall. Mexico still might pay for the wall if you interpret paying for the wall in broad terms. So if NAFTA disappears and we end up having tariffs on Mexican imports, there's one way of paying for the wall. I don't predict that, but we'll see. So what are the policies of principles of immigration policy? Again, nothing's written down, but as nearly as I can tell, the view is that immigration control will slow down drug imports. There's no evidence that that's true. Immigration control will reduce violent crime and terrorism. I don't know if that's true. I can tell you that the evidence that we have from sociologists and economists suggests that where immigrants locate tend to have less violence than where they do locate. But the reason for that is because they go to where the jobs are, where the income is growing fast. So nobody's really sorted this question out very well. Greatly limiting low-skilled immigration will raise U.S. native wages and employment. There's probably some truth in that, but not a lot, because And the right way to limit immigration is to, one, virtually eliminate legal low-skilled migration and refugees. Refugees, the number of refugees, I don't know if you have followed this, you probably have, but the last year of the Obama administration, 100,000 or so. This year, 2018, will be 45,000. Next year, it'll be 15,000. So an economy this size, accepting 15,000 refugees from the Middle East, you could just see that there's a pretty strong policy emphasis here. And then shifting the proportion of refugees sharply toward the higher skilled. Despite that, the administration is making it more difficult for foreign students to arrive and to stay after graduation. This is Knox's other big problem with the Trump administration. So how most economists see this issue, immigration flows are largely unrelated to crime and terrorism. That might surprise you. I don't know, but it's for reasons I just mentioned. There's certainly, what that means is if you take a random sample of immigrants and natives and sort of see in which group do you find more crime, controlling for everything that you can, there's no real distinction. Okay. There's significant and robust evidence that immigrants do not displace very many native workers and actually raise the local native wages modestly because they do interesting complementary work. Let me tell you what I mean by that, very simple level. But this is actually a pretty solid finding. So had your roof worked on? You have somebody cutting your grass, anything like that? So what you will observe in that market is that when you're going to replace your roof, some American who speaks English is going to come to you and talk to you about the contracting, the pricing, and the design, and you sign a contract with that guy, everybody's happy. But he never shows up to put the roof on the roof. That's a lot of immigrants doing that, and probably most of them are illegal, right? So what is that telling you about the economics of this? The guys on the roof don't speak English, and they don't really want you to know them because they might be illegal. But that frees up the time of the other guy who does speak English to do the higher value stuff, and he gets a higher salary as a result. And we see that sort of throughout these kinds of jobs. There's some sense in expanding visas for skilled immigrants. I certainly agree with that. Immigrants, high-skilled technical immigrants, are disproportionately responsible in the United States for major inventions and entrepreneurial activity. So if you just want to look at the numbers, you know, the number of Nobel Prize winners in science in the United States is large, but the share of those being won by immigrants, foreign-born who become Americans, is quite large and still growing.
I think this is really a rhetorical question, uh-huh. But we bring in the high-skilled people, there are they going to maybe robotize and lose jobs for the low-skilled people?
That is possible. That is quite possible. Yep. Now, again, I mean, I think I've made this argument enough, but if we don't get serious about how to manage the problem of low skills and inadequate mobility, then we will find a situation where we're going into an equilibrium where we have 40% of the population unemployed. I hope that doesn't happen, but we need to do something about it. And attempts to restrict legal immigration will run into further problems. We have a growing labor shortage. It may not sound like it from what I just said, but right now we do. And then you all know about the demographic issue with aging. And who's going to pay for our Social Security? Who's going to pay for our Medicare? And who's going to change our bedpans? And on and on and on. By the way, you saw the news that the unemployment rate fell below 4%. You want to know why it fell below 4%? Because the amount of jobs created was well below expectations in the market. It's because people are retiring faster than other people are entering the market. So the denominator is going down faster than the numerator is going up. So we have this aging problem. It's worse in places like Japan, I can tell you, and some of Europe. But in this country, the sort of solution to that problem for a long time has been higher birth rates than other countries, but also immigration. We'll see where that goes. So all of this makes me wonder if this new restrictive approach is itself sustainable. I think I was going to try to convince you that Americans really aren't turning inward. Just let me show you a chart or two that you might find interesting. This is a survey done of Americans' attitudes toward foreign trade in 2016, so election year. You'll see in 2016, the dark green line is the share of Americans who responded to the survey who think that international trade is an opportunity. It's a benefit. And that hit 58% in 2016. That's the highest it's ever been. And here's another interesting pair of charts for you. This is about immigration. The one on the left on top is what are your view about immigrants? Do they strengthen the country or do they weaken the country? And again, if you look at the top one, the number that think, the percentage that think that it strengthens the country is up to 59%, again, in 2016, the year Donald Trump got elected. And those are historically high numbers. They really are. I mean, even in the sort of heyday of globalization in the 1980s, you wouldn't have seen numbers like that. Well, what's going on? A couple of interesting observations. This is same question, but the reds are the Republicans, the blues are the Democrats. So this is part of the fractionalization that you can see out there. And this one really is kind of amazing. This is attitudes that are positive towards migration by age cohort. And just take a look. The older you are, the more you dislike immigration. The younger you are, the more you like immigration, which is a little bit inconsistent with the whole idea that you're worried about your future labor market conditions if you're a young person, right? So I don't know what explains that. All I want to say is that I don't think it's right that you should interpret the 2016 presidential election as a wholesale dismissal by the Americans of the benefits of internationalization. Instead, we had all kinds of unique circumstances going on then. And certainly there's a large minority of people who were worried about all of this kind of elitism and globalization. And that leads me to my last slide, because I really talked too long. Is Trumponomics sustainable? Sheer speculation. Okay. Almost entirely wrong. Economists are really bad at making forecasts, especially about politics. So I think we see that there's not much evidence that American people as a whole are turning inward. And we're getting this pushback from business that's likely to slow down the administration's drive for trade conflicts and strong immigration controls. It will surprise me if the administration is able to get Congress to agree to a dramatic reduction in illegal immigration. It will really surprise me. And at some point, maybe already, members of the public and even Trump's base will realize that the tax reform was oversold and may very well be personally costly for them. So would trade barriers, by the way. Who do you think pays the highest percentage of their income to pay for import tariffs in the United States? It's low-income households. The reason is our highest tariffs are on labor-intensive toys and clothing and things like that that really matter for their households. Does all of this mean that the Trump agenda is doomed? Well, maybe. But the economy is going to grow pretty robustly through 2019 or 2020, unless there's some major disruption, which I don't see. And we all know about this tremendous fragmentation, distrust about government. By the way, did you know, latest survey, 9% of Americans approve of Congress, 10% of Americans approve of communism? I'll leave that to you. And that made fertile ground for Trump's election 2016 and might indeed do that again for his re-election 2020. Who knows? But there we are. My own view of all of this is we are living through what I would call a historical aberration. It may last longer than 4 years, but nevertheless, I don't really see that the fundamental dynamics and economic situation in the United States will support this kind of approach to policymaking for a long period of time? Okay. Happy to take 2 minutes worth of questions. Please, yeah.
It seems like Trump has a lot of slogans, and either he listens to people or he doesn't carry through on them. So is this not maybe quite as worrisome as it might look like? I mean, he talks about tariffs, but he doesn't implement them.
Well, I will remind you, and I'm sure you know this. There are there's at least one area in which they're making a really big difference already, and that's in terms of the regulatory burden placed on American businesses, and some of that should go away. But in terms of climate change issues and environmental questions, I think we're being pushed back a number of years by what they're doing. That's unfortunate in my mind, at least. But so they're not without influence, to say the least. But beyond that, these sort of big national policies, the president seems to want to do whatever makes him popular in the day. And so I'm sure that's frustrating to his staff all the time, but it means that there doesn't seem to be a sustained bit of momentum towards anything in particular yet that I can see. Mm-hmm. Paul, yeah.
How much of the current state of the economy, the job market, and so forth, is due to residual Obama policies versus new Trump policies?
Well, so again, my opinion. We went through what you remember, a severe economic recession, which was a financial crisis. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but when you look at the history of recessions, when they are not financial, we bounce out of them pretty quickly. When they are financial and they are of that scale, it takes years and years to recover from them. So the Obama people put in what, in my mind, was not a sufficient kind of recovery program, but it's all they could get politically. Mm-hmm. And that's had some positive effects. But what really made this difference and is now pushing this economy along these days is the massive monetary expansion that you got in the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, again, pretty wonky, but they quadrupled their balance sheet, which means printing money in a big, big way. Now, a lot of the idea was to get people, especially businesses, to invest that money, even though interest rates were really low, and they didn't for some time, but now we see that picking up. So I think what we're seeing now is pretty much the long-term cyclical reaction to those changes, plus growth that's going on in Europe and Asia and everywhere else that's sort of all coordinated. It's rare in the world, so we're kind of lucky that all of the major parts of the world economy are growing at the same time, reasonably robustly. So that is happening right now. So that's why I say I don't really see anything changing that for another 2 or 3 years, no matter how good or bad the policymaking might be in Washington. But I don't think any of it can be laid yet, positively or negatively, at the feet of the Trump administration. The tax reform is too new. And that's really all they've done of any real magnitude so far. Yeah.
I was just wondering your opinion. I saw a picture of you with a panda.
Oh,
and I'm very interested in China myself. But fundamentally, how do we compete against a country that big with that many people? The single-party system, where they can be entirely pragmatic and scientific about economic growth, and we're almost entirely political and driven by special interests. As an example, I spent some time in Xinjiang in western China, and the way that the approach they took to developing it was to give the Chinese Academy of Sciences a project to figure out the optimum way to develop that region, and that's the way they operate, and who's going to argue with them? And how do we compete against a system like that? We've been losing by a factor of 4 or 5 over the last 30 years in terms of growth.
Well, we have another hour and a half. Chinese are not... Let me start by saying the Chinese face their own difficulties. A lot of it is driven by the sort of hidebound political system they have. Young Chinese, and we call them yuppies, but in the engineering sector, in the finance sector, education sector, are really, really unhappy that there are these restrictions on their access to technology, to communication, and coming, there will be restrictions on their access to travel. So I suspect that there will be some difficult times for the Chinese. Their banking system is half insolvent now because so much of it is lent into similarly dodgy real estate. But the Chinese government and the size of the economy are such that I think they can probably weather all of that and still keep growing at a pretty sizable rate. So how do we compete with that? Well, I think partly what the Trump administration is doing is right, doing a bit of confrontation and saying, you know, we're just not going to sit back and take this that long, much longer. Where that's going to go is anybody's guess. But I think it's really about making sure that the internal structures here, especially in terms of making sure that our people can compete in a world like that, are done. And I just don't see that happening in a significant way. So, I mean, we're going to take too long on this, but if it were up to me, we'd be investing in a big way in cost-sharing programs with corporations so that they would start training workers in manufacturing and construction, whatever it is, that actually generate high incomes. We would have the government, whether it's state governments or federal governments, subsidizing mobility of workers so that somebody who thinks that she's stuck in Kentucky actually could move to a place like Colorado and sort of increase our income by 15% overnight doing that. These are all long-term structural issues that need a lot of debate, but we're not having that debate.
Kind of sounds like Xi's plan for Chinese or socialism with Chinese characteristics. Mm. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, the people really that I know, and it's not many, but fair. They're not happy, and they can't publicly. I've stopped communicating with the Chinese text program, WeChat, with a lot of my Chinese friends, if the text is in any way political. Not that I'm worried about it, but I'm worried about what it means for them. So this is not a healthy thing that's going on.
Thank you so much.
Okay, sure. Thank you, guys.
For more news and information about Knox College, visit knox.edu.